Welcome back to Epiphany. We're on Chapter 10 this fine Thursday afternoon. Good to have you along. We will be, actually, it'll be Thursday morning that'll come up, but it's still the same to me. As we remember, back on Chapter 9, we had Dan Stevens over in Davis, West Virginia, along with James Hamner, an agent of the FBI, and they are investigating, or they've just been investigating, a case where a good friend of Dan's had gone and had his church burned down, much in the way that Dan's church has burned down previously. Chapter 10 is actually on Emily's perspective. I do go back and forth on those. It also contains a little bit of family history. Those of you who might know me, I might know the history that I'm about to delve into. And that's really about all I can say about this, other than away we go. Epiphany, Chapter 10. Emily's dreams are troubled. They were, at first, peaceful. There was fire, confusion, and the form of someone running away. She knew who it was, but could not put a name to the face she had seen before. She woke up in a cold sweat at 5:15. Something wasn't quite right. She couldn't put her finger on it, but something wasn't quite right. She lay in bed for the next 2 hours, catching occasional bits of sleep before finally giving up. Emily Stevens had just gone downstairs to turn on the morning news when her phone rang. "Emily Stevens, this is Bob Barada of the FBI. I was the agent in charge of the investigation of the fire at the community church, remember?" "Yes, I do remember you." A wave of dread washed over the pastor's wife. "I don't know if you had a chance to see the news this morning, but there has been another church fire, this time in West Virginia," the agent spat out. "I recall you saying something about you sending your husband there. Did you?" "He left after Sunday morning services." "That's probably why the county sheriff out of Davis is looking for him." Emily's heart sank to her knees. "Please, Lord, keep him safe," she prayed silently. "He seems to think that your husband may have set a church on fire based on an anonymous tip." Silence. "Mrs. Stevens. Mrs. Stevens?" Fear started to take hold of Emily's heart. "Can I call you back?" she finally said to the agent. "Of course," he told her. She hung up the phone, filled with doubt, filled with fear. Dan had been showing signs of needing something that she just couldn't put her finger on. She had trained in the art of counseling, yet she couldn't apply that training when it came to her husband. Uncle Mike came to mind. Mike was driving with Emily's Aunt Susan when he pulled over to the side of the interstate, suffered a heart attack, and died. Susan was a nurse who had CPR certification. She could have kept her husband alive at least until an ambulance arrived to take him to a hospital. Instead, she froze, helpless. By the time help arrived, it was too late. Emily found that she was now facing a similar crisis. Dan showed signs of depression, of not being able or willing to carry on his duties at the community church. Emily saw the signs, yet felt helpless, unable to do anything about it, even though she was becoming equipped to be able to help. Hope wandered into the kitchen, clutching her favorite toy, a stuffed dog she called Ralph. She put Ralph on the kitchen table before sitting down herself in expectation of a bowl of cereal. "Where's Daddy?" Hope asked. "He's taking time off. He's out of town," Emily answered. "Why?" "He needs it." "Why?" "He works very hard and loves a lot of people," Emily tried to explain to Hope. "Why?" "It's his job, that's why." Hope seemed content with the answer. She waited until Emily served her bowl of cereal before speaking again. "Do you have a job, Mommy?" "I have a very important job. I take care of you." She emphasized the point by touching Hope on the nose. "You take care of Roger, too, don't you?" she Hope said, holding up her stuffed dog. "Taking care of Roger is your job, just like Gracie takes care of Frank." "Why?" "It's the way it is, Hope," Emily explained while sitting down with a bowl of cereal for herself. "Each of us helps each other. It's called loving your neighbor." "Like Mrs. Larson next door?" "Like Mrs. Larson next door." "Do I have to love someone living 100 miles away?" "Yes, you have to love some people that you don't even know." "Do I have to love people, someone I don't like?" Hope asked. "You have to love them especially good," Emily told her daughter. "Why?" "Because sometimes the people you don't like are like that because they don't have anyone to love them." Hope paused for a while to eat her cereal. She finished, placed her bowl in the sink, gathered Roger, then started to walk toward the living room. She stopped. "I'm glad we had this talk," Hope stated, as a matter of fact. "Me too," Emily assured her. Maybe she was assuring herself. At 7:45, Jacob, Peter, and Gracie were making waking noises upstairs. Frank, the dog, preceded them, heading out to the back door so he could be let out. He came back in at about the same time the other three children entered the kitchen to let loose a flurry of cereal boxes, bowls, spoons, and milk. While the children attacked their breakfasts, Emily quietly stole into Dan's downstairs study and called Jabo Hatfield at the Mental Health Center. "Jabo, Dan may be in trouble. I got a call from Bob Barada of the FBI this morning. There was a church burning last night somewhere near where Dan was staying." "And they suspect him?" Jabo asked. "There was an anonymous tip," she told him. "Given what we've been talking about, could it be possible that he snapped and become an arsonist?" "Anything's possible, but not necessarily probable. Arsonists tend to have other problems than what we've been discussing about Dan." "I thought so. I wanted to be sure," Emily said. "It's just that I'm worried." "Wait it out," Jabo prescribed. "Give it a day. If there was a tip like you said, chances are that the police would figure out sooner than later that they've reached the dead end. In my opinion, the cops would be better off looking for the tipster. Find the tipster and you'll have a much better idea who might have started the fire." "Is there even the remotest possibility that Dan may have started either fire?" A feeling of dread gripped Emily again. "There always is that possibility," Jabo conceded. "I don't sense it, but there is that possibility." They conversed in general for another few minutes. Jabo volunteered to come to visit Emily on his way home that evening. "If you don't mind, I could use the help," she told him. "Maybe some therapy, you and the kids," he suggested. "Would you consider to come out to the farm with the kids or visit later this week?" "I'm not sure," she hesitated. "It might do you and your kids good," he offered. "We're having people over on Friday for a swim down at the swimming hole behind the house, followed by a cookout." Emily had heard stories about the swimming hole Jabo was talking about. It was a place where the locals in and around Jumpstart would go and skinny dip. Before Hope, she would have taken their children down to the hole to let them splash and play to their heart's content. Since moving to Magnolia, her three older children had outgrown naked romps in the backyard sprinkler afforded by living out in the country. They still slept naked, but had gotten used to dressing before leaving their rooms in the morning. Emily took a deep breath. "I think I'll have to give it a pass." "Give what a pass, Mom?" Jacob had somehow wrested himself away from the activities going on in the family room. "We'll talk later, Jacob," she told him. "Sorry, Jabo," she returned to her conversation with the counselor. "The boys are getting to a certain age, you know." "I understand," he replied. "Let's talk later, okay?" Emily agreed before heading back to the kitchen to clean up the morning dishes. She was surprised to see Jabo's friend, Jacqueline, standing next to her son, helping him clean up. "Oh, hi, Mom," Jacob perked up when he noticed his mother. "I was going to tell you that Jacqueline was here when you were on the phone." "Well, I see that you've decided to let her help you get ahead on your chores," Emily smiled. She knew that her son was anxious about spending time with his friend. He was also out to impress the girl. "It's okay, Mrs. Stevens. I'm glad to be able to help," Jacqueline chipped in. Emily sat down at the kitchen table while the pair of teenagers made a game of finishing the breakfast dishes. Emily's mind drifted back to her first boyfriend, a quiet kid from church named Eric. He was a year older in age, but not quite ready for her advances. She enlisted her father's help in inviting the boy over to the house to spend time at a cookout and have swim in the backyard pool. Emily was determined to make Eric the first boy she kissed on the lips. She remembered the day. It was warm and sunny. She went with her father out to Eric's house to pick him up. Her father squeezed both of them in one seat belt on the front seat of the red Nova. Eric squirmed while Emily tried to think of how she could steal that kiss. Since he was about to go into the 8th grade and she into the 7th, he must have already had experience. That was part of what 7th graders did, have their first kiss with someone of the opposite sex. When they arrived, Eric was almost immediately shuffled into her bedroom to change into a swimsuit while she changed into hers in the bathroom. The thought of a boy naked in her bedroom was somehow exciting for her. They arrived in the backyard at almost the same time. There was some back and forth before they were playing innocent games in the small above-ground pool. Eventually, she had him right where she wanted. Emily stole her first kiss from Eric. In front of her parents, too. The rest of that afternoon was anticlimactic. Emily had a hard time trying to figure out why Eric didn't seem as thrilled as she was about their kiss, or why he didn't try for another one while he was there. Boys reach their emotional maturity later in life than girls do, her mother explained. Give him another year or two, he'll most likely come around. Eric and his family moved away before he was old enough to give Emily a proper kiss. A smile coursed across Emily's face while she watched her son and a girl with the same hopes and dreams as she did when she was her age wash dishes together. Jacob had no idea what was in store for him. Her whiff of nostalgia was interrupted by the jarring ring of the telephone. Jacob picked it up. "For you, Mom," he said. She picked up the receiver. "Bob Baratta again. Just thought I'd let you know that your husband is safe for the moment. He's with an agent working on the case. No charges have been filed, but the agent told me that the local sheriff is getting antsy, wants to make an arrest." "He will be kept safe, right?" Emily asked. "Our agent on the scene will do his best, although the sheriff has been known to bend rules to get his way," Agent Baratta reported. "I'll pass along your phone number so an agent on the scene can be in contact. I'll touch base with you periodically, too. Don't worry. Dan Stevens is in good hands." And that's Chapter 10. Chapter 11 next week. We're going to be back with Agent Hamner and Dan Stevens at breakfast, or having breakfast in town, and heading back out to the site. Really, that's about it. 13 minutes, and that wraps it. Until next time, be seeing you.